Change happens. How we respond to change can make or break us and our careers. Join us for an intimate insight into how influential and authentic people lead through change. The good, the bad, and everything in between. Because whether we like it or not, change happens.
Hi, I'm Janelle McMaster, and welcome to Season 2 of the Change Happens podcast, where we continue to have conversations with influential leaders on leading through change and the lessons learned along the way. Now, if you haven't listened to the podcast before, I do encourage you to go back and have a listen to Season 1. We've had some cracker guests, and certainly today's guest will be another case in point. Today, I've asked the pioneer of the Business for Purpose model, or DET Excel, to join me to explain how this concept works and her incredible journey to getting there. A few minutes into a conversation with Audette, and you can't help but be hit by two things. She truly is a citizen of the globe, and she's a formidable person of many talents, not afraid to experience and drive change. Audette grew up in New Zealand, studied and worked in law before moving to Hong Kong, running a Bermuda bank and chairing the island's stock exchange. She even signed the Bermudan $5 note while working on the board of the financial regulator. In 1998, she shifted gears, founding her own philanthropic business, the Adara Group. It's a fascinating model, which consists of an investment banking advisory business, as well as a not-for-profit international development business. Now, what's fascinating about this is that all the profits generated from the investment banking side are used to fund the philanthropic development work that Adara does in Uganda and Nepal. The aim is to bridge the gap between for-profit and for-purpose modelled organisations. Bearing all that in mind, it makes absolute sense that Audette calls herself a lefty who loves a deal. Now, Audette has had an unbelievably long and impressive list of awards and accolades, and if I was to try and run through them, I guarantee you we'll be here all day. And I'm actually keen to speak to her, so I'm going to say that amongst the many, many titles she has, Audette was awarded an Order of Australia in 2013 for her service to humanity and leading philanthropist by Philanthropy Australia in 2016. The former pink-haired, skydiving, self-described wild child feminist activist who fights for human rights every single day is an absolute force, and I'm totally delighted to have her join me for this discussion today. Audette, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Janelle. I'm really delighted to be here with you. Cracky, that's quite an introduction.
It is indeed. But I loved writing it because there's just so much to try to summarise in there.
I'm delighted to be here with you. I love the fact that you're opening this space and discussions about change and how we lead into this new world. I'm really delighted to be a part of it. So thanks for having me on.
So much to get into. But I'm going to start the conversation with an understanding of the impact of COVID on your world. It's hard to ignore the circumstances that we find ourselves in and have found ourselves in over the last year across your companies, your teams and the populations you serve. Now, I know you were on a plane coming home from New York. You were planning Adara's emergency response in March last year, 2020. And in 1 week, you decided to arrange for your workforce across multiple countries to go to work from home. Take me through that time. What was going through your head? I can only imagine the stream of thoughts that were happening. And how did you go about getting people safe, accessing technology and working productively for their respective communities, some of which would have been incredibly challenging to work through?
Yeah, I mean, what a time in our world that was and still is, of course. And I think like millions of people, you know, my mind was going, you know, 1,000 million miles an hour trying to figure all that out. I'd been in New York late February and early March, New York and Boston. And it was very apparent over there that the world was going to need to close down and that COVID was going to become incredibly serious. So that long flight back from New York to Sydney, I had a lot of time, whenever it takes 28 hours. And so for that entire flight, you know, I was really thinking all the things you're talking about, how can I keep everyone safe? How can we do the work and serve? And what tools are we going to have in our toolkit to provide service? Because as you know, we're health and education service deliverers in remote communities. How are we going to manage? So by the time I sort of mapped a plan, by the time I landed and went into the office, our poor head of IT, this wonderful, very senior guy, David, I said to him, David, we're going to go to work from home all over the world. And within 1 week, and I think he'll forever remember that conversation. But once I'd climbed the mountain of figuring out what we needed to do. The rest was just implementation. So, and isn't that the case so often in life? It's once you make the decision, it's all about effective implementation. So that was about occupational health and safety, about getting people set up from home. And in the countries we work in, that's not necessarily so easy. And it was also about the global leadership team coming to grips with the fact we had to throw out the plan that we'd written for the year and start all over again with this key question: what tools do we have in our toolkit now? So it was a very, very intense time. I think the whole global team is very proud of how we managed it. Mm. But weirdly, having 28 hours to sit on a plane on my own quietly and map my way through as the leader of the organisation was actually a bit of a gift, looking back.
Yeah, I can imagine. And look, I think your point is a good one around, you know, the mental shift around, you know, what is it that we're going to do as opposed to the execution side of things. Both are really critical in that equation, but this one in particular would have been so challenging. And it's one thing to make such a big call. You know, as you said, the world's going to close, which is a really interesting sentence to wrap your head around, right? Mm-hmm. I can only imagine what David's reaction or his face would have looked like when you landed and said that. But then implementing it, you when I think about Uganda and Nepal, where you know you do so much work, the infrastructure isn't there, the backbone of the economy is not there, incredibly remote locations. So the implementation side of that is no small thing. Like, where do you start with that?
Yeah, it's massive, isn't it? There's a couple of advantages we had. The first is we're a global organisation, so we've learned over the years how to work virtually with each other, even though we're also frontline service deliverers. So, you know, we have teams of people who know about, you know, whether it's Zoom and Skype and SMS and WhatsApp, and who are used to dealing with their colleagues. We run like one team, even though we're all around the world. And we've also learned our way into how do you work in low resource settings? How do you make sure you've got enough battery backup? How do you make sure, you know, that you've got the key equipment you need? So we had some advantage in that. I think, too, it was a testament to the quality of the global leadership team in particular and the teams that flow underneath them that the seriousness of the situation was such that we could sort of, it was a bit of a call to arms in a way, and it wasn't just a directive from leadership, it was built from the ground up. So we need to replan everything right now. Every single member of the organisation is involved in this process, and we brought it up very fast. We have a brilliant global leadership team. There are a few things that were really apparent to us, you know, the simple and obvious stuff. We need to get PPE on the ground immediately. Mm. And luckily, we do have supply chains, but, you know, the speed that things were closing and the lack of access to critical life-saving equipment, a lot of it was about prioritising. When things are really terrible, sometimes our brains want to not believe. You know, I think avoidance is a great emotional coping strategy.
Fantastic strategy.
But not in a situation like this. So being able to work through, this really is happening. And we have to analyse every single risk. What tools do we have in our toolkit? What are our assets? We're going into lockdown all over the world. You know, in March, when Nepal locked down, everywhere was locking down. And here we are, we've got hundreds and hundreds of development specialists, you know, healthcare providers, education specialists. How can we serve people when we're in that situation? And the conversations that came out of that were riveting. So, for instance, we were one of the first in Nepal to get radio education on the air. Because we realised, our teams realised, okay, we can't, schools, we're in 16 schools, they're all going to close, but people are still going to be on the radio.
Yeah.
And so we led the radio education work, formal and informal. We were ahead of the government to get that out there. And we're very proud of that because once we sat and thought, we thought we can still do that even though we're sitting in our own homes. We've got teachers. They're in their own homes. They can get on the radio. Health education work that we do in Uganda, we know that we can do a lot of work by SMS and messaging. So it was a riveting period, actually, in terms of figuring out, gee, we can deliver service even when we're locked in our homes, even when the world is closing. And for the service that has to be delivered in person, we can deliver it as safely as we possibly can if we equip our teams properly. So, and some of the things we've learned, we will carry forward COVID or no COVID.
I was just going to say that. No doubt it's surfaced some innovations and some learnings and some evolution of work that you've been doing that you would take forward.
No question. I mean, we'll be better service deliverers going forward. Our teams are blown away that the radio education, let me give you a great example of this, all of a sudden we realised all these people were tuning into radio education, illiterate women who never had the chance to go to school are suddenly tuning into radio education. How cool is that?
Very cool. I feel like that's a rhetorical question, but I needed to get involved.
So, isn't it out of adversity you learn, right? You rise. And so there's a whole lot of stuff that we've done that we'll take forward into the future. And as I say, there's a sort of sense of pride in the organisation. Gee, look at that. Okay, we made mistakes. We always make mistakes and we always face our mistakes. But there's some cool stuff that we did that was going to take us forward.
I love that. And speaking of the word learn, you know, that what you've learned in this time, what did you learn about yourself in leading through these turbulent times? And also, what did you learn about your team as leaders?
Yeah, let me take that in reverse order. I learned that my team around the world are even more outstanding than I ever dreamt. Mm. Oh my goodness, the heroes that I get a chance to stand beside. These, the not only the depth of thinking and compassion, the effort in the face of terrible fear. You know, these extraordinary leaders throughout our work. You know, they just stepped up. I can't even begin to tell you how breathtaking, you know, some of it was, and how honoured I am to work with them. So I never thought I underestimated anybody in our team, but holy cow, when the chips are down, you know, the quality of leadership. So their ability to turn on the dial, their ability to be courageous. One thing for us sitting here in Australia, our US team have really been in the teeth of it too, unfortunately, as you know, with COVID, but to be sitting here, you know, mandating and coming up with great ideas. Another thing to be sitting in Uganda when people with COVID are coming into your project sites and dying, or to be in Nepal when, you know, you've got kids in our most remote education sites with COVID. We don't have any, tertiary medical facilities within day's walk. It's a whole nother level of courage and leadership. So what did I learn? I learned that, you know, I thought I knew how brilliant they were. Now I really know. What did I learn about myself? I learned that it's really hard to lead from behind the line.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm a leader who I'm somebody. When the Nepal earthquake happened in 2015, the first thing I thought after, oh my God, is everybody alive? Is everybody safe? Was when's the first aeroplane there? I've always wanted to lead beside and if in front of. We're going over that hill, and I'm going first type leader. That's not necessarily the right way to lead at all times, but that's me. So suddenly I had to learn, okay, you've got to not only lead, you have to hold everybody from behind a screen. And your job is to keep everybody safe and listen to every voice, but you can't do it beside them physically. You've got to do it from behind a screen. And gee, that was a challenge. So, yes, I hope I'm a better leader now, but it was a big learning for me. And there's plenty of times I got off my Zoom calls and I put my head on the desk and cried. It was a big learning.
What did you – so I'm really – I just want to stay on that for a moment, because leading from behind, it's an interesting concept, isn't it? So what sorts of, competencies or traits or attributes did you have to dig deeper on or call upon in leading from behind that you might not have had to if you were out there at the front?
Yes, it's a holding, right? I really do think that's the right way to think about it. Leading from behind is a holding. Mm-hmm. So you have to listen more. I think I listened more. I was at some points very directive, but I think in general you have to listen more, and I had to listen more. There's a thoughtfulness, there's a mothering, there's a caring and compassion when you hold a team that are facing crisis. I had to be more present. And I think we've all become a bit more present, right? Because we can't be thinking next week I'm going to New York, the week after that I'm in Nepal, right? This is what the plan says.
You have to stay in this moment.
You have to be right there.
Yeah, okay.
And you have to be completely available, emotionally available, available by way of time, available by way of thinking. So, it's a different kind of leadership. And I hope it's added another tool in my toolkit, or I hope I'm a better leader. Leadership's such a privilege, right?
Absolutely.
For the whole world, it was an enormous year.
And I imagine in your world, when I see photos of you in Uganda and Nepal, as I've seen many of them, you know, touch is a big part of, you know, you're wrapping your arms around communities.
Yes.
And, you know, there's a whole physicality behind taking resources and seeing, you know, it land and seeing it in practice, and not being able to do that must have been an incredibly difficult time, and continue to be.
It's funny, isn't it, that there's a visceral grief when you can't be, and everybody's experiencing this in different ways, physically wrapping your arms around the people that you love or that you care for or that you're responsible for. And in fact, I was just talking last night to some of our teams and saying, just wait for the party when we're all together in Uganda. Just wait for the hugging we're going to be doing when we get back together, or Nepal's going to be the same. All of us. I mean, it's not just me, not just Adara, not just one country. This is something our whole world is going through.
Sure.
And we're all facing this in different ways. But it will be a good day when we are together, and there is going to be a lot of celebrating and laughter and hugging when we can finally do that again.
People the world over waiting for borders, you know, to come down for that very thing. Now, COVID has clearly done a lot to bring the topic of economic and health security right to the forefront of every conversation, whether it's in our households, you know, across the dinner table, or it's at the bus stops, or wherever you are, or across organisations, communities, whole societies. It's been something. I'm just wondering whether the fact that it's at the forefront of everyone's conversation, has that helped elevate the cause of Adara, or has it kind of caused care fatigue? You know, we've got so much stuff to have to care about: local employment, the regeneration of our economies, the bushfires, Black Lives Matter. Is this a helpful, or is this helpful, or is it a hindrance that there's another thing?
It's such a hot topic for me, and it's something I'm feeling really a lot of anguish and passion about. Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, tells us that, you know, when you feel unsafe or insecure in your own home, it's impossible for you to think about other people's needs. And I think there's been a layer of that. There's not been a whole lot of information in the public domain about what's actually happening in the developing world. Mm. I think it's a bit of a paradox, right? Because we can see now, it couldn't be more clear that a stranger's health risk is everybody's health risk. You know, from one person, you know, in wherever this began, and, you know, with bats or whatever it was in Wuhan, here we are with this global crisis. So we're, you know, it shows us that, you know, how our health is, public health is a global issue. And we know that, you know, the WHO tells us, you know, that it is having a higher standard of health is a fundamental right. Yet we also now see it's completely unveiled how disparate our access to quality healthcare is. You know, 50% of the world's rural population, 20% lack access to institutional healthcare. We see it now. But is there fatigue? Are people able to look outside and care for others? Yeah, there is fatigue. People aren't looking outside as much as I wish they were. And I think it's almost so overwhelming to people that in some ways people almost can't take it in or don't want to know. But unfortunately, we've got to figure out how to take it in and know. We've got to care for the amazing, our neighbours in faraway places, not only because, you know, that's what compassion and values tell us, but also because we're all connected. So if they're not well, we're not well. And so from a purely pragmatic point of view, we have to get our hands around the global health situation and the economic situation globally. But I'm worried that this conversation is not in the public domain in the way that it should be. And we see this with vaccine equity. You know, the lack of access to vaccine in some of the places it's needed the most, and the stockpiling of vaccine by wealthy countries. It's a disgrace. Pushing up of vaccine prices. so that they're not affordable because of the stockpiling. So, you know, these are issues that as a world, I mean, we have this moment where we can show greatness as a world through this crisis, or this moment could take us the other way, into smallness, into closure, into not caring. And I think, you know, there's so many people who are going to make sure and fight to make sure that we do go to greatness. But I think the battle is going to wage. And I'm proud that Adara is going to stand on the side of trying to do our best for our neighbours in remote countries every single day. I think it's critical to who this world, what our world becomes.
It's I'm very grateful for organisations like Adara and for people like you to keep this, to hold us all to account and show that we can continue to expand our compassion beyond our own views. I'm going to come back to that, but I'd like to just turn perhaps the conversation to a bit about you. You grew up in New Zealand with your family, but you obviously with your family, but you started to travel at an early age and see the world from quite early on in your life. What impact did that start have on where you are today?
Oh, huge, I think. My dad was this wonderful journalist, and so for a period of our early lives, we were in Singapore during the Vietnam War times. And so I remember very clearly being very shocked when I went back to New Zealand to find myself in a country where everybody looked like me.
So yes, because you were the minority, if you were.
I was the little blonde-haired, blue-eyed kid in Asia in the 60s. Mm. How wonderful. And so my view on our world was deeply multicultural. And actually also my early life, I thought we were in a minority, not in a bad way, but I just thought that's the way that it was. We were in Asia. And I think that's given me and set the scene for a sense of I'm part of a whole amazing global world and not everybody is like me and how wonderful that is. I've never understood when people talk about tolerating diversity rather than celebrating it.
I'm with you.
So, I think a huge set. Growing up with different language groups around you, people who look different to you, people who think differently to you, what greater gift could you be given as a child than that, right?
Indeed. You speak about being a social activist during your time at Victoria Uni in New Zealand, having a pink streak in your hair and a placard in your hand, yet you made the decision to step outside of your comfort zone and into a top law firm. And years later, you described that as a pivotal moment in your career. What made you decide to make that change and why did you see it as a pivotal time?
Yeah, it was really... I find it hilarious that people think I'm a business person who wants to give back, a business woman who, and people who really know me know that's not the truth. They know I'm an activist who decided business is going to be the way that I'm going to affect social change.
Yep.
I think I've had a few periods in my life, I don't know if you've had these, where I've had these kind of blinding moments of realisation. and there was a blinding moment of realisation as I was finishing my law degree. When everybody I knew and me expected thought, okay, now I'm going to go off and do human rights law and I will always be an activist, when I realised there's a whole part of the world I don't know about. I don't understand power and money and I need to learn it. I just had this moment of realising, oh, my God, I need to get out of my tribe. I need to go learn power. How can I create shift if I don't know power? Mm. And I went like it sort of, you know, I felt like I was the enemy going into the, or, you know, the spy in the enemy camp. Going into the business world, and it was such a great experience to step outside of my tribe, and it has formed a life where my life is about engagement. You know, and it is the tagline of Adara, as you know, is bridging worlds. Mm. I am still and always will be an activist at heart. I believe there's millions of different ways you can create social change. This just happens to be the place that I picked for my little stitch in the tapestry of change. But I'm really glad I did that because it's made for an incredibly interesting life.
Well, a couple of questions in there. First of all, when you say the tagline for Adara is bridging worlds, tell me about the worlds that you're bridging.
Oh, so many worlds. we're bridging the worlds of the most advantaged with the most disadvantaged. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we're literally Wall Street, to to the poorest streets in the world, the places where there are no streets. Mm. So you know, that's the business development world. And then on the ground, of course, we're bridging all sorts of worlds. You know, we're bridging worlds of high quality facility based healthcare with people who are living in extreme poverty. We're bridging cross-cultural worlds, you know. So we're the United Nations.
Yep.
You know, we're a secular organization. We're working with people of faith, people of all different kinds of faith, people of no faith, people of different philosophies. You know, we're a tiny little example of how much fun it is and how joyous it is when you truly unite across divide. We're anthropologists working with investment bankers. You know, we're accountants and lawyers, you know, working with educational specialists. We are like the weirdest cross-cultural, cross-sectoral, cross-skilled, cross-ethnicity, you know.
It's amazing.
Cross everything. So we really bridge worlds. But I guess the most obvious and the biggest bridge is from in the business. You know, we are advising Australia's largest listed companies, and we have got some of Australia's most highly regarded, most senior investment bankers and corporate advisors working with us to do that.
Mm.
People and the work that we do at those very high levels on sometimes deals that are billions of dollars is involved in those deals. The fees that come from that are going to places where people only eat twice a day and don't have access to the internet. So it's a huge bridge, and oh boy, it's a beautiful bridge when you see it working.
Oh, absolutely. Now, you had the sentence or the phrase that you wanted to understand power and money and how that moves, how that works. I know after you were in law, you ended up getting into capitalism, finance. You ended up running a publicly traded bank in Bermuda. I think you were not shy of 30 years of age, no less at that time, one of the youngest women to not only lead but also revive a failing bank into a profitable entity. What did you learn? Well, first of all, sort of questions about how you did that, but what did you learn about money and power through that period of time?
I learned to put aside my prejudice. You know, I learned to stop stereotyping. I also learned that you can make amazing change when you move power. And so, great example of that. Have a look at what Larry Fink's done with BlackRock.
Incredible.
You know, have a look at that amazing woman in Australia, Bronwyn King, with the anti-tobacco work that she does. Wow.
Alumni of the podcast. We interviewed Bronwyn last year.
Oh,
yes.
Love her. I mean, you know, she figured it out. How do I get people to stop smoking? I move money out of investing in tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned that there are lots of ways to make change, but a very powerful one is to move money in a different direction. Coming up to 23 years since I started Adara, that's become evident, and how wonderful to watch it. So it used to be people thought I was crazy. These ideas were crazy. Now it's absolutely mainstream. ESG is no longer, you know, environmental social governance overlays on investment portfolios or what companies do, you know, climate change as a mainstream issue. This is no longer something the crazy left are talking about. You know, this is mainstream discussion in the biggest companies and investor groups in the world. And how fantastic is that in terms of being able to make change?
It does feel like something of a tipping point. And I think folks like Bronwyn, Larry Fink have been instrumental, and yourself included. But when you began Adara, as you say, people were really, as we know, people were really doubting this concept. People certainly doubting you from the business community. I think earlier in your career, when you were taking off on traveling on a bike for a couple of years, you were approached by a senior partner in a firm you were working in and said, you know, no one's ever going to take you seriously in business again. But you had the confidence to persist. Whilst it's still difficult, I mean, you don't have to convince people so much of that now. You had the confidence to persist, to listen to your own voice despite the naysayers. Where does that confidence come from? How did you choose to defy that and keep going and then eventually come up with a model like what you've come up with at Adara?
I should tell you the backstory on the guy who told me I'd never be taken seriously again. When I ended up running the bank, and there was a little article about me in the Financial Times, so I cut it out and posted it to him.
I'm so glad you said that, because I always think you'd probably be above that. I would absolutely do that too.
I'm not a saint, definitely not a saint. So where did it come from? Okay, a weird mixture of things, I think. First of all, is total hubris. Weird mixture of arrogance and stupidity, I think. And I think every entrepreneur base, especially young entrepreneurs, you kind of need that. I think also I was raised by extraordinary people. Both my mum and my dad are incredible people. I'd say we lost dad 20-odd years ago, but I've often thought he must have sat by my bed at night and whispered in my ear, "You can do anything." You know, he was one of those men who just wanted to unleash his children. And so the two of them together, the sort of permission to fail that they gave us, the "we will love you no matter what, just get out there and have a go," they threw open the doors of the cages for us and loved us as we leapt forward. And gosh, that's such a thing to give a child.
What a gift.
It was a huge gift. So I think there's a whole mixture of things. There's also sort of this, you know, slight tenacity, I think, that I've got as a character trait. But anyway, it all came together and I'm so glad it did.
But what about the idea of an investment business funding the philanthropic side? Where did that come from?
It came from a whole journey of thinking. So remember, I came from an activist viewpoint. I went into the world of big money, big power, through law, into banking. Thought a lot about models. I'm very interested in models of change. And when I was running the bank, all you do when you run a bank, well, it's complicated, but what you do is you think all day about matching assets and liabilities and how much money you make in between that. And when I began to look at the model of not-for-profits, I realized, oh, my God, it's the worst asset-liability mismatch I've ever seen in my life. Short-term donor dollars, long-term responsibilities to people on the ground. Mm. And so I was very interested in thinking through models. And I thought, gee, maybe there's a better mousetrap than that. And maybe the model should be a long-term commitment of a business that's devoted to making money for a not-for-profit. So not-for-profit leaders don't spend every day worrying about where the next donor's coming from. They can get on with the incredible complexity of service delivery. So when I launched the business and the NGO at the same time and said, hey, we're going to run a business and it's going to make money and pay for this international development organization, and I'm going to hire bankers to make money and they're going to hand it over to the development specialists, I thought that was kind of obvious, but everybody thought I was a money launderer. It came out of this thinking about models, years and years of thinking about systems, models, change, how you engage, what does the not-for-profit sector need, what could I take from my business learning to bring into that environment. And you know, how wonderful that here we are 23 years later. My gosh, there have been a lot of mistakes along the way and a lot of learning, a lot of refining and evolving. Like any good entrepreneur, I think I'm never satisfied with what we're doing.
You said, my God, there's been some mistakes along the way and learnings. What would be some of those? I mean, 23 years on, unbelievable success. But what might be a couple of standout mistakes or things that have informed a different way forward for you that you sort of will hold dear as those lessons?
Yeah. Rushing. Okay. In the business community, one of the skills, if you're at the top of your game, is you've got to be able to make big judgment calls quickly on the base of available data. When you're dealing with human social service delivery, you have to think and you have to think again. You have to listen to a lot of different voices, particularly when you're dealing with complex cultural, religious, gender, and other issues that come in failed states that are living in poverty. So biggest mistakes I made in the early days, I rushed, trying to solve things that I didn't fully understand. Mm. And I've talked before about terrifying mistakes that I made, you know, and that I own, rushing incubators into hospital settings without consistent power supplies. And when the power went down, babies suffocating in the incubators. Oh. Really serious stuff. Mistakes that I still grieve. So rushing is a huge one. The idiotic belief that business skills translate into the not-for-profit sector, boy, that's a big one. Having to learn, oh, there's a whole new way of thinking about this and there are people who are absolutely expert I need to listen to. Thank God for behavioral scientists and anthropologists and development experts coming in really relatively early in the piece. When you sit on the knife edge of profit and purpose, as we do, you have to be really, really clear which of those trumps profit or purpose. And there's two times when you get yourself into real trouble there, when there's too much money or when there's not enough money. Mm-hmm. You need to make sure that the people who come with you on the journey understand the purpose will always triumph over the profit. And so that the alignment, culture and teams and people who are with you, oh my goodness, I've learned a lot about that, you know. And now I look at our shining teams all over the world and think, yeah, we finally got all that right. The right people are with us on the journey. The right people are attracted to us on this journey. There's an integrity at the heart of it and a culture that is that I'm just that shines, and I'm just so proud of that. I mean, on and on I could go. Not being properly prepared, you know, the horrible moment in the early days when, you know, the same week Ebola hits one of our projects in Uganda, the same time as the Maoists take over another project in Nepal, and I've got people from everywhere ringing saying, what do we do? And I'm realizing, holy cow, I don't have a disaster recovery plan. I don't have emergency evac. I don't know what to do. We don't have the right insurance. Risk mitigation, structure, strategy, planning, you name it. We've fallen down those holes. There's a whole lot of learning there. And I love that one of the things that we do at Adara freely is talk about mistakes, try to help others, try to take years off other people's learning times. For us, that's scale. Share your knowledge, including all the honest mistakes that you've made. So, there have been a lot of them.
How did you go about choosing, or why did you choose Uganda and Nepal as the two countries that you would focus yourself on?
Our work is much wider than Uganda and Nepal now. Yeah. We run across, I mean, they're the two countries where we have centres of excellence and we deliver service. But we run service delivery and we run knowledge sharing. And our knowledge sharing, for instance, our work with preterm low birth weight babies, which all exhibits in centres of excellence in Uganda, but that work is, we're on a global stage with that work. So, but in terms of Uganda and Nepal, why did we end up there in terms of delivering service? First of all, screen. I wanted to work in lowest quality places, the lowest quality of living indicators. There's a scary amount of them. I wanted to work in places that are landlocked. It was sort of a go big or go home strategy, like find the toughest places, you know, go there. I had a real bug in my, a bee in my bonnet about go remote. No one serves remote. Governments don't serve remote. NGOs don't serve remote. It's wrong. It's human rights.
So you went for the toughest. All the toughest.
I wanted to go tough. And then I had two personal connections. I trekked in Nepal, like all good Westerners, in the 80s, loved the country, met all my screens, thought people were astonishing, knew that there was extraordinary levels of need. And I had a very weird connection to Uganda. When I was running the bank, I used to go across with all those famous people to Davos. It was quite a lurk of the job, being a young woman running a bank. So, and in a coffee shop in Davos, I met the First Lady of Uganda and we formed a friendship. This was years before Adara. And we wrote to each other in the old-fashioned way before the internet. And she said to me, I think on year two or three, if you ever, I said to her, one day I'm going to come and do something for you in your country. I'm going to come and help. And she said, if you ever come to Uganda, I will open every door for you. Aww. I will make sure you're safe. And so literally years later, I drove up to Government House in Kampala and buzzed the buzzer, you know, remember me. I figured if you want to work in a country, you should. It helps to know the people who are in charge.
It really does.
Weird personal connection as well as the screen.
I think I told you, weirdly personal connection, the two countries that have most profoundly impacted me in my life has been Uganda and Nepal, having spent time working in both of those countries. It's just bizarre. So there's something in the, I don't know, in the stars. It's meant.
How magical, how beautiful those people are. And, you know, and how wonderful that doing that great work with all those amazing communities, it's now touching the lives of people in so many different communities. It's so incredible. People come into Uganda, learn about NICU from us and take it into other countries. How wonderful is that?
It's wonderful.
We love both countries.
And Odette, you know, I know we've talked about the change that you have been doing, but if you were to articulate, you know, in a sentence, the change that you are seeking to make happen in the world, what is that?
It's a good question. I'm not seeking to make it happen. I'm seeking to be a part of making it happen because I recognise we're only one stitch in a huge tapestry of change. The change I think we need to see in the world is around equity. We need to see social justice. We need every little girl in this world to wake up and have the same opportunity as every little boy. We need every child in this world to wake up and have the same opportunity, no matter where they're born. You know, I believe profoundly that everyone has the right to essential service delivery, no matter where they live. That's the change that I want to see in the world. It's not too much to ask for fairness, right? And if you want a beautiful read, you know, if I was on a desert island and I had to take a book I would take the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Okay.
That's the change we need to see in the world. We need the Universal Declaration of Human Rights to apply to all.
You said we're only one stitch in the tapestry of change. I think, so what strikes me is that, and even your examples of rushing, you saying that you felt like you were rushing to solve some things, it seems that, you know, you've taken a step back, you've been doing things like working with business and bridging worlds. Tell me about your views on how you drive change at the system level.
That's a really good question and something that interests me greatly. I've always been really interested in activity and action, not talking and policy. But as I'm getting older, and now we're a couple of decades in, I'm realizing, okay, actually it's time to start thinking about systems change because that's what will really turn the dial. Systems change is not only, and it was not, in my view, unfortunately, politics, or is rarely politics and policy. It can be. Systems change is actually changing the discourse and the way that people view their roles and responsibilities in the world. So I think systems change is happening around the way that business views its responsibilities in the world, for instance. I think systems change is happening around a universal understanding across all elements of our society and economy that climate change is an existential threat. I think we need to get systems change happening around rights of marginalized people, that everybody is entitled to the same set of rights. How do I think about that? How do you begin to play into that or be a piece of that? One way to do it is to get into the world of policy. Another way to do it is to lead by example. I believe that sometimes you can inspire people to systems change. So you can show people what's truly possible. I had the great honor of interviewing Muhammad Yunus a few years ago, and he said to me, the way to make systems change is to do one thing brilliantly and have people copy you. And I thought, yeah, that's right. And that's sort of what Adara is trying to do in a little way. We're trying to do that. It's also about being a voice, right? And I'm trying to figure out what our voice should be and what my voice should be. You know, being a voice, sitting on the board of big companies, having the business credentials, being a voice for change at the moments with people of influence and companies of influence and systems of influence. I think there's a whole lot of different ways to achieve that, but certainly from our perspective at Adara, the expertise we've got, for instance, in newborn health or remote education, you know, we're now moving to a level where we can say, okay, can we start to be involved in systems change through the knowledge sharing piece, through the influence piece, through the voice piece? And we're kind of finding our way through. But yeah, I'm thinking about that much more. And I actually think we're living in a world now where if you never saw it before, boy, you see it now. Do we need systems change? Yes, we cannot continue with the way that this planet is and the way we've been operating the planet. We've got to make systems change.
So, Odette, no doubt you've got countless stories and moments that are, you know, that you have in the back of your mind. But is there any particular moment or particular story that you think about when you think about having made a change happen and Adara making a difference in communities? What's one or two stories that you might be able to share with us?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to tell you some good stories. I mean, it's funny to me that this is a life that people sometimes think has involved sacrifice. But, of course, when you do this kind of work and you're connected to communities like this, you know that actually it's the opposite of that. It's a life full of joy. So I will give you one example of that. One thing we're pretty well known for in our work in Nepal, our remote community development work, is working with kids who we've taken out of the child trafficking trade. And we do a huge amount of work in child protection now, and it involves thousands of kids. But there are 136 kids who are incredibly dear to, particularly dear to my heart, and who sort of started us on this journey. And they're a bunch of kids that we pulled out of basements now nearly 14 years ago. Littlest ones were three and have been in our lives all that time. They're part of the Adara family. You know, they're health educators, they're engineers, they're teachers. I mean, they've gone on to do amazing things connected to their own community and their families of origin. But I had a wonderful moment. There's one kid in particular who went off when he finished, when he graduated school, he went to Dubai, which was very scary for us because a lot of Nepali people go to the Emirates and are treated very badly. Anyway, off he went, and like nervous parents, we worried about him and we followed him on Facebook and fussed. And he started off working in Dubai, basically, you know, peeling vegetables. And I think it was at Thank God It's Fridays. And then he ended up as a sort of sous chef. And then out of the blue, I got this email from him saying, you know, Auntie or Dad, I have got a job in Australia. I was picked from 200 applicants and I am coming to work at a very expensive restaurant in Sydney. Amazing. So I sent him a note saying, get into my office the minute you arrive. I want to see you. Anyway, he's gone on to become a really serious chef. He ended up out at Woolgan working out, you know, in the Emirates out there. But when he first came, the first year he was here, as it was Mr. Wong's he came to, and he told me in a very embarrassed fashion, he said, Auntie or Dad, I have to tell you, you probably won't be able to afford to eat at the restaurant I'm working at, which is so wonderful. I had this wonderful moment. He volunteered for us as well as working full-time. He came and worked a day for us in the Adara office, and I had this one moment where I was running down the stairs, and his name is Turing. He was running up the stairs into work for Adara, and I was like, hi, you know, namaste, namaste, how are you? And as he ran past me and as I ran down the stairs, and I thought, oh, my God, it's all worth it.
Oh, it's quite a symbolic, almost like a sliding doors moment as you pass each other that way when you think about him being pulled out of a situation when he was a child.
Right. And there he was, you know, having an amazing life, you know, at the highest levels of his profession. There he is. And, you know, the Jewish community has this amazing, beautiful saying, which is that if you save a life, you save the world. And I believe that to be a profound truth. And so there's one life, right, that made it all worth it for me. And there's so many, many more. I mean, there's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. But it was just that moment where it was crystal clear to me, oh, it's all worth it.
There must be times, and I'm sure there have been hundreds where thousands over the years where it just feels like maybe you aren't getting the kind of traction and change you want to. I wonder how you keep going. There must be rage about the inequality that drives you, which inevitably would give way to disappointment when things aren't getting done. How do you not let frustration, fatigue, defeat, anger, injustice, all of that, how do you not let that take over you, and how do you keep going?
Yeah. First of all, I am enraged. I am enraged by inequity. I'm angry every day on behalf of the poor. Mm. But I have learned that speaking with anger or rage, it's not helpful. People just shut down on you. So better to turn that, to channel that into action. Mm-hmm. Do I feel defeated? Of course I do. When I'm on project sites, last year I cried a lot last year. However, what I also feel is, oh, thank goodness I'm doing this. You know, how would I look at myself in the mirror every day if I wasn't getting up every day and trying? And it's also about taking your wins, right? Celebrating with the victory. When I'm in Uganda, I always go through this, oh, I'm so inadequate, it's so useless. I always go through that. What I do in Uganda is I get up in the morning, first thing in the morning, last thing at night, I go to the NICU, the neonate ICU. And it's beautiful when the dawn's coming up and there are all these tiny little babies in there who, many of whom, a huge number of whom are going to grow up and have beautiful lives, who wouldn't be alive if we didn't do this work. At the moment, the census is we're taking nearly 60 a day in there at the moment. And I walk around in there and I go there before I go to sleep and I think, okay, it may not be enough, but it's good work. And thank goodness I'm doing it.
Thank goodness you are.
So that's how I do it. But the same as every other human being on the planet, I get filled with anguish and despair, filled with doubt and insecurity, and then I get up and do it again the next day.
Mm. Now, I know that you were awarded the Order of Australia back in 2013, some time ago, but, I mean, that would have been something of a highlight amongst those moments of rage. What impact did that have?
I was totally astonished by that because I'm not Australian. I'm a Kiwi. So it was an incredible honour to be honoured by Australia as an AO. I was nominated, as it turned out, by a wonderful man who lives next door to my mum and dad in a little town called Mollymook, who lived next door to my mum and dad. Mm. His name is Ron. This wonderful man in Mollymook did all this work and I got the AO. And unfortunately, he died before it was awarded to me. But he knew that I got it, and he was very proud of the fact that he'd got it. And so I quietly call it Ron's Medal. It was a gift to me. And, yeah, it's a huge honour. It's a badge of credibility. You'd like being in the Masons, that little button that they give you to wear.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes when you're a woman, this happens to me less now I'm older, but, you know, you're generally underestimated. So it's kind of nice to have a little sign to people of, okay, this woman has been honoured by the country.
You're doing all right.
Yeah, it's a very nice thing, and I'm very grateful for it. I was appalled by some of the stuff that's happened around the awards recently, yes. But I feel very honoured to have it.
Well, well done to Ron, and well done to you.
Good on Ron.
Yeah, good on Ron.
The last three fast questions on change to finish the podcast.
The first question is, what are you reading, watching, or listening to right now? I have made a note of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a recommended read.
I don't read that to relax.
Assuming you're not reading it right now, what might be, what are you reading, watching, or listening to?
If I did want to read another incredibly beautiful, important document, by the way, on my desert island, I'd be reading the Statement from the Heart, the Uluru yes. Statement from the Heart. Mm-hmm. If any Australian hasn't read that, they should. It's the most beautiful, moving document. What am I reading right now? I'm an escapist. I love novels. I read a lot of trash as well as some good novels. I always read the Booker Prize. And I try the lot to read the long list as well as the short list. But right at the minute, I've just finished a brilliant Louis de Bernier book. I don't know if you know his book's good. It's called The Autumn of the Ace. Oh, it's wonderful.
Okay.
And I also just finished another wonderful book called The Shadow King, which was shortlisted, which I absolutely love. So I'm an escapist reader. I can also be found reading, I love a good spy story.
Very good.
Those are the kind of things that I read.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to compile this end of the year for our audience of the recommended reads or watches from our guests. That's really helpful. What is your superpower? I feel ridiculous asking this. You've just spent me 45 minutes telling me all about your superpowers, but let's go with something that maybe is even a useless party trick. Any other superpowers up your sleeve?
Oh, bloody hell, I don't think I've got any useless pally tricks. I think if I had a more serious superpower, and of course that's a very grandiose title, right? But I think I think people don't understand about me. Some people don't understand that if you try to tell me no, you will encourage me enormously. I've been like that since I was two. I think my mother would tell me I've been like that since I was zero. So I think a really useful superpower is that put downs, disrespect, and being underestimated has supercharged my life.
It's your fuel.
It's my fuel. So, or it's been one of my fuels. So I think that, I don't know if that's a superpower or not. But,
yes, I think it is.
Just never bloody tell me no. That's probably the superpower.
I love it. And if you were going to put a quote up on a billboard, might be something that you've said, it might be something that stays with you that you've heard someone else say, what would that quote be?
I think at the moment, and there are a lot of them obviously, but at the moment I would probably put up, we are all connected.
Mm.
That to me is the message that we need to take out of what's going on in our world right now.
Oh, we're living and breathing it, aren't we? You know, as you say, a bat in Wuhan has impacted us all. So for better or worse, we are all connected.
Exactly.
I'd love for it to be better.
Yeah, well, it's got to be better. We're going to make it that way, right? You know, there is I'm a huge Leonard Cohen fan. Mm. And one of the, I don't know if you like Leonard Cohen, but I'm a worshipper. And one of his great songs is The Anthem. And there's a line in it or a chorus, and it goes like this, something like this. It is, ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. And to me, that's the answer, right? Forget your perfect offering. We can't be standing back waiting for the world to be perfect. We just have to figure out, where's the crack? Where's the light? Go there. And as long as we're doing that, we are going to make a better world.
Oh, I love that. And I do love that. And thank you so much for your time today. So, I mean, I think this is a conversation that people will need to listen to a couple of times over. I feel like I need to probably play this back, but I'll continue to take things away from it. Certainly, some of the things that stay with me right now is, you know, the courage to forget what you planned and the discipline to remember what you know and what you can do with that. I guess the learning around what it takes to lead from behind, that you need to call more on listening, caring and compassion. I think the power of bridging worlds, it's only when we bridge worlds that we find the level of common understanding. We can park our prejudices that we might have around the other worlds. And whether it's hubris or arrogance or stupidity or unbelievable sense of compassion or an understanding of driving systems change or debt, you have been moving mountains and made such an impact in this world. I love clearly your humility in talking and your honesty in sharing mistakes, the power of learning from those mistakes. And the only way we learn is if we exercise humility and we create psychologically safe conditions for people to share and reflect on their learnings and we're curious. You know, I want to say thank you to your parents for encouraging and unleashing their children on the world because we are so much the better for it. I love that you, the power in not taking no for an answer, and may we remember the words of Leonard Cohen and we go for the light. Thank you so much, Audette.
Absolute delight to talk to you. Thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
The Change Happens podcast from EY, a conversation on leading through change. Discover more where you get your podcasts.